What's the Israeli public reaction to American students' pro-Palestinian protests?
Among Jewish Israelis, however, there's a sense that these students are just anti-Israel and they're not taking them all that seriously.
Plus, today is World Press Freedom Day. We chat with the head of RSF, or Reporters Without Borders, in the U.S.
It reflects a few trends that we're seeing. We're seeing in countries all over the world, political actors are more emboldened to denigrate the media, to vilify the press, to attack individual members of the press and journalists.
And later, a look at upcoming elections in Chad and an update from Kyiv. Today is Friday, May 3rd, and this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. We'll be taking a look at Israeli reaction to American students' protests in a few minutes, but getting us started today is U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin. He said on Thursday that he did not see any indication Hamas was planning any attack on U.S. troops in Gaza, who were there to build a pier to allow for the delivery of humanitarian aid.
Of course, I don't discuss intelligence information at the podium, but I don't see any indications currently that there is an active intent to do that. Having said that, Phil, this is a combat zone, and a number of things can happen, a number of things will happen. The safety and security of our troops is very important to me.
The United States has called on both Israel and Hamas to ensure that aid bound for civilians in Gaza is not disrupted after a shipment from Jordan was attacked by Israeli settlers and subsequently diverted by Palestinian militants. Meanwhile, the United States is promoting a plan for a hostage release and ceasefire between Israel and Hamas. The plan also envisions the eventual establishment of ties between Israel and Saudi Arabia. However, the proposal comes amid tensions between the U.S. and Israel over Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's insistence that Israeli forces will invade Rafah. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken visited the Kerem Shalom crossing point and Ashdod port and confirmed that Israel has responded to U.S. demands to increase the amount of aid going into Gaza. But he also voiced clear disagreements between the United States and Israel over Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's repeated intention to invade the southern city of Rafah. Netanyahu insists that Israel must invade Rafah to fight the last four battalions of Hamas there and locate Yahya Sinwar, the leader of Hamas in Gaza, creating pressure for a hostage release. But President Biden has made it clear he is opposed to a Rafah operation unless Israel can guarantee safety for the more than 1 million civilians sheltered there. A ceasefire in the Gaza war is also seen by the United States as a precondition for the normalization of relations between Israel and Saudi Arabia. This normalization deal was put on hold with the outbreak of war between Israel and Hamas, but the U.S. is devoting intensive efforts to revive it. Jonathan Reinhold is an expert on U.S.-Israeli relations at Bar-Ilan University.
The normalization of relations between Israel and Saudi Arabia could have a transformative effect on the whole of the Middle East. It would strengthen America's allies, all of whom are committed to maintaining stability in the region. And it would weaken the enemies of the United States and those countries, primarily Iran and its allies.
Reinhold says Saudi recognition would greatly benefit Israel in its struggle against international condemnation.
For Israel, it would greatly strengthen both its diplomatic and its military position, its strategic position. Diplomatically, it would make it much more difficult for those who seek to undermine Israel's legitimacy, who seek to undermine it diplomatically through boycott and divestment and sanctions, if indeed the largest, most prestigious Muslim state in the region and perhaps in the world normalizes its relations with Israel.
Some reports in Israel say that Saudi Arabia is so interested in the defense pact with the U.S. that it might normalize relations with Israel even without a ceasefire in Gaza. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Jerusalem.
More regional reaction to the lack of a ceasefire deal comes from Turkey, who on Thursday said it would halt all trade with Israel. It's an estimated $7 billion worth per year until a ceasefire is reached and humanitarian aid begins to flow. It's been a turbulent few days in the United States as college students across the country and around the world are facing arrest for joining in pro-Palestinian protests, even as the U.S. government continues to support Israel politically and militarily. What's the reaction inside Israel to this mixed message? To find out, I speak with VOA's Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem. We begin our conversation, though, discussing recent developments in the ceasefire negotiations. Has Hamas reached a decision?
Well, the latest is that there seem to be contradictory things coming from Hamas. They have not given an official answer to the latest proposal that's on the table, which Secretary of State Blinken, who was here this week, said that Israel has accepted and that now the ball is in Hamas's court. And first they said yes, then they said no. Now they seem to be saying maybe, but they have not given an official answer despite saying every day that they would. So basically, it's just not clear. And I think there's some disappointment in Israel, certainly like on the streets, because there was hope that maybe this thing would be moving forward.
Okay, well, we'll certainly stay tuned for details as they break. But another topic I'd like to discuss with you is it's been a big story in the news here in the United States and around the world, and that's the student protests against Israel's military operations in Gaza. Some are calling them pro-Palestinian. Critics are calling them anti-Semitic. There's a wide range of politics going on around these protests. Given that the United States is such a large supporter of Israel militarily and politically, how are these protests in the United States going over amongst the Israeli public?
Well, I think, you know, first of all, the Israeli public is kind of involved in, still involved in the war in Gaza. You know, reservists are being called up now for a second round of reserve duty. And so the protests do feel a little bit away, far away. At the same time, I think a lot of Israelis see them as anti-Semitic, as you mentioned. They feel that these American students are not in touch with reality, that they've kind of forgotten that this war began when Hamas attacked Israel, and that if Hamas would release the hostages, there would no longer be a war in Gaza. What's interesting is that several Israeli universities have said that any American Jewish students who feel unsafe are welcome to transfer to Israel. I'm actually working on a story about this right now and can, you know, will help them transfer their credits. That applies to lecturers as well, you know, professors who want to come to Israel. And there's even a company a for-profit company that helps new immigrants says that it will give their services to students who want to leave the universities in the United States, will give their services for free to help them transfer to Israel where they can feel safer.
Interesting. So what is such a large dominating story in the U.S. and other parts of the West isn't registering very much on the ground in Israel?
No. In fact, Hamas in Gaza and Palestinians in Gaza have welcomed these demonstrations, saying that they really welcome the support of students in America. Among Jewish Israelis, however, there's a sense that these students are just anti-Israel and they're not taking them all that seriously.
And we'll leave it there for today. VOA's Linda Gradstein is in Jerusalem. Linda, thanks for your reporting.
Thank you, Steve.
You're listening to Flashpoint, Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. The White House marks World Press Freedom Day by saying the free press is an essential pillar of democracy, and the women and men worldwide who uphold it do vital work. The statement goes on to say that journalism should not be a crime anywhere on Earth. On World Press Freedom Day, we honor the bravery and sacrifice of journalists and media workers around the world, risking everything in pursuit of truth. France-based media rights group Reporters Without Borders, also known as RSF, issued its annual report on Friday and highlighted, among other things, the deaths of journalists in Gaza. The World Press Freedom Index is the world's only ranking of 180 countries and territories according to the level of press freedom they grant to journalists and media, as assessed each year by RSF. My colleague Michael Lippin sat down with RSF USA Director Clayton Weimers this week and inquired about the main trends in press freedom around the world over the past year.
There is a global deterioration in press freedom around the world, and it's being felt most acutely in one particular indicator that we measure, which is the political indicator. So our index measures press freedom on the basis of five indicators: political, economic, legal, social, and security. And we've seen movement on all of them, but by far the biggest drop around the world was on the political indicator.
Why is that?
It reflects a few trends that we're seeing. We're seeing in countries all over the world, political actors are more emboldened to denigrate the media, to vilify the press, to attack individual members of the press and journalists, to seek to weaponize the government apparatus against individual media outlets that are critical of them. So overall, the climate from a political standpoint has deteriorated.
When we look at how RSF has been reporting on the Israel-Hamas conflict, RSF was highly critical of Israel in this year's report, downgrading its ranking to 101 and downgrading its categorization from problematic to a difficult country for press freedom. And in early April, RSF also issued a statement online calling on the international community to put more pressure on Israel to stop, and I quote, the massacre in Gaza of Palestinian journalists. I wanted to know why we haven't seen this kind of strong language also being used publicly by the United States and Israel's other Western allies who tend to have, you know, the most influence on Israeli policy.
You know, that's a great question, and it's one I ask myself. I've been in countless meetings with officials from the United States government pleading with them to take a harder line with Israel because the level of killing that we're seeing in this war is devastating. We have not seen so many journalists killed in a conflict in such a short period of time in modern history. The numbers are simply jaw-dropping, and it reflects, on the one hand, just a culture of total disregard for the safety of journalists in the field, and on the other hand, a culture that seems to be permitting the targeting of journalists. We have documented a number of cases where we have to conclude that the journalists were the targets of airstrikes or of Israeli fire because there's no other way that they could have come under attack.
RSF has said that more than 100 Palestinian journalists have been killed since the start of the conflict. And when you have your conversations with the Biden administration, when RSF tries to share these findings also with other Western governments that have sway with Israel, Israel can point to, you know, evidence that it says it has, that most of these Palestinians who are identified as slain journalists are also members of terror groups involved in their media wings or their military units. And I wanted to know, how does RSF respond to Israel challenging your definition of who constitutes a journalist?
Frankly, it's offensive. We take great care investigating each and every case. We do not count anyone who we reasonably think could be considered a Hamas militant among the journalists that we have counted as casualties of this war. You know, the great care that we take is actually one of the reasons that sometimes you might see differing numbers out there from other groups that might count or other governments that may be counting, because we want to be 100% certain that everyone that goes onto our list of killed journalists definitely was a journalist. And in fact, we go a step further and we count specifically the number of journalists who we can demonstrate were killed in the course of their work as journalists, and they find themselves targeted by IDF airstrikes and snipers and machine gun fire. And, you know, we simply can't accept the word of a government that has demonstrated a total lack of remorse for killing these journalists. And it, by the way, it did not start on October 7th. Israel has had a very poor record on protecting journalist safety in Gaza and the occupied West Bank going back years. And some viewers may be familiar with the case of Shireen Abu Akleh, for example, the Palestinian-American journalist who was shot in the head by an Israeli sniper in a case that was extremely brazen. So this is not a new problem, but the scale is definitely new.
One more question on this issue, and that is, how persuaded is RSF when the Israeli military makes statements like it has, you know, over the course of this conflict, that the Israel Defense Forces have never and will never deliberately target journalists?
If that were the case, I think we'd be seeing very different results in this war, frankly. And whether or not it's the case that they're deliberately targeting journalists, it is still a war crime to indiscriminately fire into civilians. And if you are indiscriminately killing journalists, you are just as liable. So I think you just have to look at the results to know how much stock to put in statements like that.
That's VOA's Michael Lippin speaking with Clayton Weimers, Executive Director of RSF USA. Our coverage of press freedom takes us to Africa, where VOA's Nairobi Bureau Chief Miriam Diallo explores the relationship between the media and governments across the continent.
During elections in many parts of Africa, journalism has suffered. That's the findings by media watchdog Reporters Without Borders, or RSF. Sadi Boumarang is the head of RSF's Sub-Saharan Africa Bureau, based in Dakar, Senegal.
We have seen, for example, in Madagascar, where nearly during the election period, nearly 10 journalists has been, you know, either attacked or persecuted or even arrested. We also have seen the same trends during election time in Nigeria, where nearly 20 journalists and 20 reporters, they have been attacked, persecuted, and harassed during the election.
Morang says they've also observed that in some places, politicians created their own media outlets to impose their own narratives.
This was the case, for example, in Senegal, where we have seen ahead of the, in the run-up to the election, for example, the birth of many newspapers, most of which were belonging to politicians.
Restrictions on access to information was also noted in the Sahel region. Niger's ranking fell 19 places to land at 80, Burkina Faso plummeted 28 places to rank 86, and neighboring Mali is at 114th place. All three countries are run by military hunters.
In Burkina Faso, there is no longer international media. There is no longer international reporters, international correspondents. That's also the case in Mali. And that also has been the case in the latest junta's ruling countries, which is Niger.
Last week, Burkina Faso suspended several Western and African media over their coverage of a Human Rights Watch report alleging the killings of civilians earlier this year by the country's military. The U.S. Department of State this week said it's very alarmed by the action. Vedant Patel is a State Department spokesperson.
Far too many governments use repression to silence free expression, particularly against journalists and media organizations, for simply doing their jobs.
In East Africa, Eritrea took the last spot in the rankings. One of the world's most censored countries, the government there has shut down all independent media houses for more than 20 years, according to Freedom House. And as of late 2023, the Committee to Protect Journalists said that 16 reporters remain behind bars. But in other places in the region, Victor Buere, Director for Media Training and Development at the Media Council of Kenya, lauds what he calls a dynamic media space.
Uganda has, I think, 300 radio stations, Tanzania more than 300 radio stations, Kenya has 290 radio stations. That tells you that largely we are talking about a very expanded media space.
But there are still challenges associated with the profession in the region, he notes.
If you are a journalist in Uganda and you have seen, especially around election time, if you put on a press jacket, you are marked your end.
There are a few countries on a positive trajectory, including Mauritania, where state media dominates the landscape, but abuses against journalists decreased, making it jump 53 places in less than a year to rank the highest in Africa. Tanzania also rose 46 places. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
And on World Press Freedom Day, we get yet another sad reminder of why it's important. A journalist, the president of the local press club, was assassinated Friday in Pakistan's Balochistan province. No group has immediately claimed responsibility for the attack. Balochistan has lately experienced almost daily attacks, mostly claimed by ethnic Baloch insurgents. Pakistani security forces are also accused of targeting critics of their counterinsurgency operations with attacks and enforced disappearances. And now to Ukraine, where residents are expecting intensified shelling in the coming days as the Orthodox Easter weekend approaches. Meanwhile, in Kyiv, President Volodymyr Zelensky meets with the Minister of Foreign Affairs from Great Britain, David Cameron. VOA's Anna Chernikova reports from Kyiv.
This weekend is Orthodox Easter, and in Ukraine, people are preparing to spend time with their families and baking Easter bread. They're also expecting intensified Russian shelling, similar to the two previous Easter days since the beginning of the full-scale Russian invasion. Meanwhile, President Zelensky met with the Minister of Foreign Affairs of Great Britain, David Cameron, in Kyiv to discuss the situation at the front line and the new aid package from Great Britain, which was announced last week. Zelensky announced that particular attention during the meeting was paid to preparation for important international events that will take place soon, in particular, the Global Peace Summit in Switzerland next month. For his part, David Cameron has announced that Britain will provide Ukraine with more than $3.7 billion of military aid every year, the biggest pledge of UK support since the full-scale Russian invasion in 2022. Importantly, he also noted that Ukraine has the right to use British weapons on the territory of Russia. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
The Central African nation of Chad holds its elections on May 6th, and in the run-up to the vote, authorities have cracked down on the media and opposition leaders have been kept off the ballot. Despite that, experts say Chad will remain an important ally for Western security forces in the Sahel region. Henry Wilkins reports.
Mohamed Idriss Deby came to power after his father, Idriss Deby Itno, was killed on the front lines of Chad's war against the rebel insurgency in 2021. He appointed himself transitional leader and military ruler, a move critics say was unconstitutional. If Deby wins Chad's elections on May 6th, as analysts expect him to, he will legitimise his rule and become civilian president. Meanwhile, prominent members of the opposition party have been banned from appearing on the ballot and say speaking out against the government is risky. In February, one major opposition leader, Yaya Dillo, was killed by Chadian security forces who said he was resisting arrest. His party said Dillo was assassinated. Analysts say Deby's influence is growing in Chad and beyond. Mali, Burkina Faso and Niger, all of which were closely partnered with the West in the fight against militant groups linked to Al-Qaeda and Islamic State in the Sahel, have seen military coups in recent years, in part on a wave of anti-Western sentiment. Following the coups, Western troops were ejected. Chad has avoided such a coup. While French troops remain in Chad, media reported on April 25th that US troops would leave, at least temporarily, or until the election is over. The US began pulling its 100 military personnel from the country in early May. Henry Wilkins, VOA News.
And that's going to wrap up today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until next week, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. issues in the news explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with the 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.